Welcome back to a good old-fashioned episode of the Baseball America College Baseball Podcast. My name's Jacob Rudner. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Peter Flaherty. And Peter, after a while of doing live shows on YouTube, which were tons of fun, and being able to interact with a bunch of people, for the first time in a couple weeks, it's just you and I. We're back to do the college podcast as we did in the good old days. We thank you all for listening and sticking with us. We hope you're enjoying your off season. Peter, why don't you tell the good people how you're doing and what you've been up to in these last couple weeks?
Yeah, while the podcast has been on a little bit of a hiatus in the last couple of weeks, the content really hasn't stopped over at baseballamerica.com and also on our YouTube channel and our podcast channel. So we've been cranking out stuff with the MLB draft. So it's been pedal to the metal with draft coverage for all of us. And you know, we've kind of taken our, not our foot off the gas a little bit, but it's become a more manageable point in the calendar. I've been bouncing around from Cape League game to Cape League game, trying to get a feel for all the top dudes in the league and getting out and trying to see at least one game a day, sometimes doubling up. So it's been a fun, productive summer. And, you know, I think like everybody, maybe some more than others, I'm ready to flip the page to 2026 and get rolling on it.
Well, we are certainly kind of doing that, not just in this podcast, where we're going to talk about the transfer portal, some draft winners as it relates to 2026. But at the very end, we are going to have a quick conversation and our final thoughts. Not to give anything away here, I have a very 2026-centric final thought for this podcast. So we are definitely starting to turn the page here. One place that I think the best, you know, starting spot is for that is with the draft. We saw the draft complete. A lot of schools did really well. A lot of big-time schools got players to go back that maybe we didn't even necessarily expect heading into the draft. We're going to talk about that. And I want to start with draft winners. Who, Peter, were the teams for you that stood out as the biggest winners on draft night? For those of you who missed it, I put a story the day after day two of this year's draft on baseballamerica.com/college about draft winners and losers. But now we're going to broaden out the conversation. Are there any that stand out to you?
Well, I'd highly recommend checking out that story for starters, but Tennessee stands out to me as a winner. I know in the transfer portal, they haven't necessarily made as much noise as people may have thought they would make, but I thought they made out really, really well in the draft. They retained Brandon Arvidsson, who had legitimate top, I don't know, 5 to 8 round buzz. And then I guess in the transfer portal, you know, they netted a huge commitment from Henry Ford. At the time, it looked like sort of a classic commitment for leverage move out of Ford. And it wouldn't have been all that shocking if he had gone in the second or third round and signed for over $1 million. But he went undrafted. Will make his way to Tennessee. He'll be the headliner within their starting nine next year, and a huge piece for him. And then they also got Evan Blanco out of the transfer portal, and he went undrafted. Pitchability lefty, it's strikes over stuff. The stuff's a little light, but he'll pound the zone. The competitive pitch percentage is really good. And then they netted a couple of their top recruits and wound up getting them to campus, and Cameron Appenzeller, who's a projectable left-hander with a really appealing ceiling, and Trent Grindlinger. That quartet is going to give them a huge boost as they look to retool and reload heading into 2026. So that was one of the main winners for me. I think we can keep bouncing schools off each other, but that they stood out to me initially.
And I think that you could say the same for largely the same reasons about schools like Georgia, Mississippi State. They all did excellent in terms of being able to retain talent that they might have expected to lose. For Georgia, that was the case mostly either on the already on the team or potentially, you know, transfer talent side. For schools like Mississippi State, that was all over the board in terms of people who had remaining eligibility, junior college players, transfer portal commitments. Jack Bauer, the super hard throwing lefty, is seemingly headed to school here. So Mississippi State won huge. It was a big weekend for the Bulldogs, both Bulldogs, Georgia and Mississippi State. There were also some winners, in my opinion, though, Peter, like Arizona State, if I was to bounce the next one off of you, that didn't necessarily win for what they retained, but perhaps what it did for them from an exposure and just kind of reputational standpoint. Arizona State has long been one of the most prominent schools in terms of producing draft talent. I believe that they still lead the country in total draft picks, or they're in the top 3 at this point all time. This year, they had 9 guys go in the draft and were ultimately tied with Arkansas for the most players picked in the first 10 rounds. Really good draft for a school like Arizona State. I think at the same time, and you and I have talked about this on podcasts of previous, that's also kind of a double-edged sword. You have that many players get picked in the draft, but then you look at their season and they barely get into the tournament. They get eliminated as a 3 seed in the UCLA regional. Kind of indicative or you know, a not so flashy point there on the resume, because you look at that and you say, well, you could have been a lot better. So where do you net out on teams like Arizona State that saw a lot of talent go, but maybe didn't have the season that they or we expected for them?
I think it's positive from a marketability standpoint. I mean, it's long been known as sort of MLBU, may or may not be a self-anointed nickname, but they have almost 500 total draft picks, numerous big leaguers, most notably guys like Barry Bonds, Dustin Pedroia, and a whole lot of others. But I'm with you where I think it's really positive. You know, it matches the total set by the 1981 team. They won the national title, but at the same time, and this is something we talked about in the lead up to Selection Monday, as the season kind of progressed, you know, Arizona State in January and early February, if you had came to us and said, you know, you have a crystal ball and that Arizona State would be hosting, we wouldn't be all that surprised just because of the sheer amount of talent they have on the roster. And like you said, it shows in the amount of guys that they had drafted. So it is almost bittersweet. Obviously, you want all your guys to go on and have long, successful professional careers culminating in playing in the big league. So I think it's, you know, it's reason to celebrate and be proud of your team. But at the same time, I'm sure there's an itch sort of in the back of your brain where it's like, man, this is all we could do with a team that had all that talent. But I don't think it's very productive to focus on that, you know, just from a coaching staff standpoint and a program standpoint. I think you got to flip the page to 26, build off of the season that was in 25. You still made a regional, you get all these draft picks. You have a really strong returning core, both with guys that were already in Tempe and are making their way to Tempe via the portal in 26. And it's another ASU team where when we sit down and do our first top 25 call for 26, right after this podcast, actually, we'll discuss them to be ranked inside the top 25. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see if they can build off of however much momentum they built in 25, however you want to quantify that. But 2026 is a big year for ASU and Coach Bloomquist.
Right. There's no doubt about that. And I'm glad you mentioned the way too early 2026 top 25. Today is Tuesday, July 22nd. And by the way, this is also a great opportunity to mention the off-season version of the podcast will come out every other week, and we'll be recording and publishing on Tuesdays now. We were on Mondays during the season. We will continue to be on Mondays when we get back into season mode. But for the off-season, we're giving Tuesdays a try, and we should be out earlier in the day a little bit as well. And again, that's going to be every other week. The other thing I was going to mention is Wednesday, July 23rd, depending on when you're listening to this, we will have published our way too early 2026 top 25. And I was going to ask you, is a team like Arizona State not necessarily the most prominent in terms of total wins or playoff performance over the last several years, and that includes this past season when, like I said, they were eliminated in the first round, does a team like Arizona State that A, does well in the draft, they've showed that they had a lot of talent, they bring back a significant amount of talent that we expect to be, you know, competitive at the top of our draft board next year. Cole Carlone, for example, one of the better, you know, arms in next year's draft and a really good college draft class for pitchers that did really well in the transfer portal and has a pretty solid high school underclassmen foundation of returners. Does that get them into the top 25 for you? And how much can a team do by rebuilding or retaining, if they didn't necessarily have success in the previous season, to jump themselves into that top 25 conversation? Can you move that much, in your opinion?
It's a good question. This is kind of a peek behind the curtain for anyone wondering how our top 25 calls go, because this is how exactly we discuss it. But for me, ASU belongs in the 25. We'll see what ends up happening when we hop on the phone and talk this through and what the rankings look like tomorrow. But, you know, I think they belong in there. Where exactly, I'm not sure, but
sure.
You know, with, like you said, with who they return, headlined by Cole Carlone, Landon Hairston, Beckett Zavoric, I think is a prime candidate to break out as a sophomore. He showed really well in a limited sample this spring. Has had an excellent summer in the Northwoods League. So those are your kind of, that's your 1-2 returning punch offensively. You've got a lot of production to replace just looking at who was drafted. But they also did some rebuilding via the transfer portal. PJ Mutsuritis is going to anchor the left side of the infield. And then you bring in intriguing hitters like Dean Toigo and Dominic Longo via the portal. That should replace some of the production you lost on the mound. Cole Carlone is in line to move from the bullpen to that Friday starter role. It'll be interesting to see how he handles the jump. But I feel like that's a really impressive anchor to your rotation. And there are a number of other guys, both via the portal and then who also showed well as underclassmen and have built some momentum here in the summertime, who will come back and be valuable pieces. So I think with who they're returning combined with who they brought in and also how all of that talent is doing this summer in high caliber wood bat leagues, I think it has ASU has the look of a top 25 team on paper heading into 2026.
And I think that is the perfect segue into our conversation about draft losers, teams that didn't necessarily make out so well. Because I also wonder on the flip side of that, how much can you punish a team that was really good in the previous season if they didn't necessarily have the most flashy offseason? And the reason I say that is because I want to talk about LSU, our reigning national champions. LSU, for me, looks like a team that's got to be, you know, in the top five, maybe definitely the top three starting next season. And that's because of what Jay Johnson's been able to do. And we've seen over time now, and this goes back to his tenure at Arizona, that Jay Johnson doesn't necessarily need the flashiest roster to have a really good season. And I think that the way that they get everything to kind of come together matters as much as exactly what they have. The sum is obviously a great factor at LSU. But you look at what happened to them in the draft, and they did, just objectively speaking, get hit very hard. They saw 8 of their high school commitments, some of them elite players, get selected and sign and are now headed to pro ball as opposed to Baton Rouge. So a lot of pressure gets put on this transfer class to come in and perform really well. It's a great transfer group. We're going to talk about that in a second. But at the same time, does it create holes? What is the forecast for a team like LSU that lost some via the draft, that did bring in some good transfers and lost a ton on the high school side? For me, it doesn't necessarily move the needle a whole lot. I still think LSU is a top contender, and I have a feeling you're about to say the same.
I'm with you. Like, on paper, they lost a lot. Their recruiting class, outside of a couple guys, Omar Cerner most notably, it kind of got gutted to the draft, and then they also lost a number of guys from this year's team, most notably offensively Ethan Fry, Jared Jones, Danny Dickinson, and then the dynamic 1-2 punch, the best 1-2 punch in the country, and Kate Anderson and Anthony Ianson. Those two guys are irreplaceable. But, you know, as the old saying goes, winners win. And that's what Coach Johnson and his staff is and what they are. And so they lost a lot, but I have no doubt in my mind that both with what they're returning, what they've brought in via the portal, that they're going to be right back in the thick of the national championship discussion for all of 2026. I have a feeling we're going to be sitting here in June talking about them in Omaha. Like, they've got it all going on in all facets of their program. And just in starting with who they return, you know, offensively, while they lost a lot, they've got that core back of Derek Curiel, Jake Brown, Chris Stanfield was a huge win in the draft for them to retain. Monster Milam, that's a really good group to build around. And then on the pitching side, we touched on Ianson and Anderson departing, which is, you know, brutal. And then fireman Chase Shores. But you also look at who they're returning. And Kaysen Evans looks primed to be that next Friday night ace in Baton Rouge. Zach Cowan is back, which is a huge win. He's a really high level strike thrower. He was deployed at times, mainly later in the season in a more extended starter-like role. William Schmidt threw quality innings last year as a freshman. He's got huge stuff. Maverick Rizzi fits the mold. He also threw a good amount as a freshman, but he's been excellent this summer on the Cape, albeit across a limited sample, but he's been flat out dominant. And we haven't even touched on their transfer portal class yet. You know, you bring in guys like Danny Lockenmeyer, who, for what it's worth and on the record, I think he could end up turning into a monster under the guise of pitching coach Nate Yeske. Cooper Moore out of Kansas is another big addition. Not only did they get a commitment out of Trent Carraway, they were able to avoid him getting drafted and signing to anchor the left side of the infield. He had a really, really good Corvallis regional. Santiago Garcia from Oregon is going to be a really key piece. So as you can tell by my long-winded, probably rambling answer and talking about, you know, a dozen or so guys for 2026, I think LSU is very well positioned for another national title run. And they're one of very few programs in the country who fit the description and fit the mold of a team that will legitimately never rebuild. It's just going to be constant reloading so long as Coach Johnson's at the helm. Like, it's the most impressive program in college baseball right now.
Yeah, I mean, I struggle to disagree with that. And I, like I said before you started talking, I think with a team like LSU, it's very hard to break what they have, if that makes sense. It is such a strong foundation that one draft that sees a lot of its players go is not going to be the thing that slows it down. Does a team like Arkansas or does a team like Florida State, both of which lost more than any other teams in the country to this year's draft off of their rosters, 11 players each for both teams, it's basically their entire rotation or their entire rotation, significant pieces of their bullpen, a huge chunk of their lineup. So the majority of their most important production will need to be replaced. They were both tied again for the most players picked off their rosters in the country this year. Do they survive it the same way an LSU might be able to? Because for a team like Arkansas and FSU, for me, Peter, they're pretty close. I actually do think that both of those programs are at a point where the answer to that question could easily be yes.
Yeah, Florida State, I have little question that Florida State's going to be able to pitch at a really, really high level again next year, perhaps an even higher level than they were this year. I know that's kind of a drastic statement, but you look at who they return. Wes Mendez is that returning anchor for the rotation, but they went out and got Trey Beard via the transfer portal, Cole Stokes, Brody Purcell, for my money's worth, is one of the more underrated transfer arms in the entire portal, and could look like one of the better portal additions when all is said and done. I think he's going to be a really good bullpen arm for the Noles. Cole Stokes, where he factors in will be interesting. Like, do they try and get a little bullish with him and shove him into the rotation? Or do they use him in that late inning role that he's become so accustomed to in Oregon? Peyton Manca's an intriguing returning arm. He was just named an all-star on the Cape. And I think his velo will increase by a couple of ticks in the fall. How they'll be able to swing it, I'm very curious about. That's a lot of production that they lost offensively. But at the same time, Miles Bailey has the most raw power of any hitter in the country. He got to it in game on a regular basis this year. He doesn't have as much protection around him or behind him as he did this spring. So, I mean, the contact ability and hitability with him those are kind of the two questions. So with him seeing more spin and more secondaries, I'm curious to see how he navigates that. But you supplement him with the trio of Cal Fisher, Hunter Carnes, and Chase Williams, you know, that's a good quartet to build around. So I think on paper, they look less talented, especially seeing what that group did this year. They look less talented on paper, but I think the upside with them remains the same. And I think Arkansas fits into a similar bucket.
I would say Arkansas definitely fits into a similar bucket. If anything, I'm maybe slightly more confident that Arkansas will sustain than I am Florida State. Again, Florida State, you're talking about losing Jamie Arnold, Joey Volini, and then two-thirds of your starting lineup. That is a really big deal. One guy who you mentioned, though, when you were talking about the Seminoles, Cole Stokes. I'll put that up on the screen right there. If you're paying attention to the site, baseballamerica.com/college, Peter and I did a list of 10 underrated transfers to keep an eye on. Cole Stokes was one of them. He's headed to Florida State in a role to be determined. Big fastball, big slider from Oregon. Kind of a fresh start for a guy with a lot of talent and just needs to have it all come together in a really big way, and he has a chance to go well. So I would encourage you to go check that out. That's why I mention it. Let's talk about the transfer portal, though. Get that off the screen. It's been an exciting offseason. You know, maybe not the flood of elite talent that I was expecting to go into the portal. There were a lot of rumors that circulated for a long time about certain guys who were going to enter the portal that never came to fruition. And I think that that could also be a sign of things to come in the future. I think that we're going to see a lot more of this talk and buzz as it relates to the transfer portal and maybe not have it come through in the revenue sharing era. I think that being able to retain talent might be, and I say might because we really have no idea, but it might be a little bit easier than what it was in just the, you know, free-for-all NIL era. Is there a player or two who stands out to you as this is the star of the class? You know, I say that it hasn't necessarily been a great year for that demographic entering the portal, but I still do believe that there are a couple. Who are your favorites right now? Or am I wrong? Do you see this as a flourishing transfer portal cycle? What are your thoughts?
I'm in your line of thinking, but like we'll see with every passing transfer portal cycle, each class will have its own degree of star power. So I think this year it's hard to say, you know, guys like AJ Gracia, Chris Akopian, Carson Tinney, Trey Beard, Joey Volchko, Jarnett Vinkula. That's kind of the main crop of dudes in this year's class. Obviously, with Coach Pollard leaving Duke and taking the Virginia job after Coach O'Connor left Virginia and took the Mississippi State job, that created this huge domino effect around college baseball, both as it pertained to the coaching carousel and then also with the portal. You saw a mass exodus of former Duke guys, saw the same with UVA guys. A lot followed their former or respective head coaches to their new schools. Grassi obviously fits the mold of that. But a handful of others, like Carson Tinney going from Notre Dame to Texas, that was a huge one. Tinney had one of the biggest breakout campaigns of any hitter in the country. First team all ACC guy. I was a little surprised he didn't go to USA. Trey Beard is an arm that we kind of saw the writing on the wall with and were able to read the tea leaves pretty clearly with him. I don't know, in late April or May or so, as it pertained to him entering the portal. Him going to FSU wasn't all that surprising a move. Joey Volchko hopping in was probably a little bit higher as a, you know, a degree of surprise. But he is the biggest stuff in the 26 class. It's just going to be a matter of if Georgia is going to be able to dial in the command and control, you know, if that Twitter report turns out to be official. He hasn't officially announced his commitment to Georgia yet, but that's certainly where it's trending and what the buzz is right now. But yeah, and I think Henry Ford, who we talked about earlier too, like we had viewed that as like, okay, Henry Ford entered the portal. He's going to commit to wherever it is. It's a leverage move. He's still going to go in a good spot in the draft and end up signing. I think him, you know, making it to Tennessee is one of the biggest individual wins of the portal cycle. I think it's hard to disagree with that. Just looking at Tennessee's offseason as a whole, what they lost and what they have to replace from this year's team that was very good. And Ford fills a lot of that hole and fills a lot of those holes and fills a lot of that void. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying, like, you know, there are like every year, there will be a number of dudes in each portal class, but that's kind of those are the main ones for me, at least.
I mean, I look at Georgia's class and I see potentially a few of the best players who I would put into this, three of the players that I would put into this conversation. You have Volchko, if he can rein it in, if that is the case, if he ends up going to Georgia officially, which, as Peter said, is the expectation. There's some reports out there saying it's done. We try and wait for the player to make his announcement, but that seems to be what's coming. You have Matt Scott, his former teammate from Stanford, who we've also been very bullish on from a draft standpoint and talked about in pretty high regard as far as his stuff goes. It backed up this year, but I'm just talking about at a certain point, at any time, we're talking about somebody who was held in, what would you say, honestly, top two round conversations, maybe even first round conversations at some point. So if you can bring that back out of him, you have another potential guy. And then the one who I like a lot, who we've talked about on this show and in a lot of different articles, is Jack Arcimone, the catcher from Richmond, who we all thought was going to go well in this year's draft as a bit of a data darling, somebody who I think marries perfectly with Wes Johnson and the way that that program likes to operate and how they try and maximize offensive players based on what they've put into the analytical calculus of the whole thing. Arcimone fits that bill perfectly. And he was supposed to get drafted and didn't, and is headed to Athens. So I really like Georgia's class. This is kind of the soft transition into the who are your top classes conversation. But those three players really stand out to me. And then my favorite, if I had to just pick one, is Trey Beard. And you and I have talked about him extensively as well. He was a frequent on the ACE report that I did throughout the regular season on Saturday mornings. Just a unique, funky, high-slotted left-handed pitcher with some intriguing off-speed stuff. Is the velocity a little bit light? Yes, and that was kind of a hanging point in our conversation of our way too early 2026 draft conversations, which we, we'll save that for the draft pod. But nonetheless, somebody who I think has a chance to be really good in the ACC for the Seminoles. Let's make that transition officially. Best classes. I think that there are some really obvious ones that stand out. We've already talked about Tennessee and what they've been able to do. Henry Ford getting to campus was a huge deal. We talked about Georgia. We've talked a little bit about LSU. Are there any classes that stand out to you that we haven't yet discussed as a part of our draft winners or top players conversations?
I actually really like Georgia Tech's class, and it's a quality over quantity type of class, but they added Jaron Advincula out of the portal, who for me projects as a first rounder. There's a little bit of Nick Madrigal to his game, albeit with a little bit more thump. Ryan Zuckerman from Pitt to anchor the left side of the infield, big 6'5 kid, can impact the baseball. Dylan Loy was used a pretty decent amount at Tennessee, consistently got outs, consistently around the zone and throws quality strikes. Justin Shattuck from Rutgers was one of the prize members of their recruiting class. All of those guys are going to have a really big impact, I think, in Atlanta. And that is on top of an exceptional returning crop of guys like Drew Burris, Alex Hernandez, Von Lackey, Carson Kearse. I'm inevitably going to leave someone out, but Kent Schmidt.
Is Mason Patel headed back to school?
Mason Patel is headed back to school. So I think that while the transfer class, while looking at it in a vacuum, is a good crop of guys, I think who they're joining helps that play up even more.
I like that.
And that could be the final sort of missing puzzle piece to them re-breaking down the door to Omaha. Because on paper, they've got the look of a team with College World Series upside. And I think the collective makeup of that group, especially with guys like Jaron Advincula, how Drew Burris carries himself, Von Lackey carries himself, that's going to be the difference maker. And you've got experience, you've got talent, you've got tools. They check a whole lot of boxes. And I think it's going to be a really, really exciting year in Atlanta.
Yeah, I think that was a great one. That I think that one thing that gets lost in this current landscape of college sports, maybe a little bit, is just how much it matters what doesn't transfer or go to the draft and the ability to retain talent. Because here's the thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we've seen in the last couple of years that you really don't need to retain a whole lot to be very good. You can replace a massive portion of your roster and go on and have that team be outstanding. LSU just won the national championship with, I believe, 14 returning scholarship players in 2025 from their 2024 roster. So you don't need that. But if you have it, it's A, rare, but B, I think for teams that aren't in the top category of NIL, that top band of teams in terms of what they have to spend, lower resource teams win big by not having guys go out. And we're going to talk about UCLA in a little bit here too. That's another great example. Before I say my top classes, is that something you agree with? I mean, where are you on the whole, you got to bring it back versus, you know, being able to just kind of replace everything? If you have the funds, do you just keep on replacing? Or is there something to be said for keeping a team, building and keeping a team?
Whenever we need to hire someone at Baseball America, we know who we need. Indeed. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Why do we use Indeed at Baseball America? Because it gets our position in front of qualified candidates. And it also allows us to do everything we need to make a hire all within Indeed. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts. You only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In this minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now. And by doing so, you're supporting our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on our podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed, is all you need. Did you know your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body truly is? It's true. Your biological age, the age of your cells and organs, is actually the number one predictor of your risk for serious diseases like heart disease, cancer, dementia, and more. That's why learning your biological age can be truly life-changing, and that's exactly what the True Age Test from True Diagnostic helps you do. With just a simple at-home test, you can uncover your true biological age and get personalized insights into your true biological age and take control of your health like never before. No doctor's visits, no labs, just a quick finger prick from the comfort of your home. I recently ordered the test myself because I really wanted to get a clearer picture of my long-term health. It was eye-opening to learn that if your biological age is just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk for major diseases can go up by 30 to 50%. That's a huge wake-up call for me. But here's the good news, and this is the part that really inspired me. Up to 90% of biological aging is driven by lifestyle. That means the way we eat, move, sleep, and manage stress plays a massive role in how fast or slow our body's age. True Diagnostic doesn't just tell you your biological age. It gives you a personalized report full of clear, science-backed steps you can take to actually slow down aging and improve your health over time. I'm really excited to see what our results will say and what I can do differently to better support my body as I age. It may be I'm adjusting my sleep. It may be changing supplements. It may be making smarter food choices or exercising more. It feels empowering to know that aging isn't just something that happens. It's something that we have control of. The test itself is super easy. Just a quick, painless finger prick. You send in your sample using a prepaid mailer, and in 2 to 3 weeks, you get a detailed online report with actionable insights that you can use. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code BASEBALL to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use BASEBALL at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
I think there's absolutely something to be said for building and keeping a team. You mentioned LSU and how they were able to do it. I think it's really positive to be able to bring in and develop your own talent and own roster. I think it's a huge testament to the coaching staff. It's an even bigger testament to the players. So I think it certainly plays a factor into it.
Let's talk about a couple more big time classes here. Here's one that I think is maybe being slept on just a little bit, and I could have saved it for our next section, but South Carolina has done an excellent job to me of putting together a roster that I think maybe has a chance, and they needed to take a massive step forward after the first year under head coach Paul Maneri. I think that this team has a chance to do it. One interesting reason for that, and I've written about this several times now over at Baseball America, is they have hardly any freshman newcomers. I believe the total right now for South Carolina is 3 heading into 2026. Everybody else on their roster are either returning talents, of which they have a pretty decent chunk, or transfers. They're up to, I think, 18 total transfers now heading over to them. That's just a huge number. It also goes to show that there has still been some institutional level investment in baseball over in Colombia, which is a good thing to see, especially after the year that they had last year. And then one that I'll repeat a little bit is Arizona State. We're gonna continue talking about them here in some, you know, looking ahead talks, but that's a team that I think did a really good job. Is there a class? Go ahead. You have something to say. Go ahead.
No, I was going to build off of how you were going to tee me up, but I think in speaking of schools where 2026 is a big year for a whole lot of reasons, I'm a fan of Texas A&M's class. Nice. Obviously, it's headlined by Chris Akopian, who's one of the better hitters, at least collegiately, in the 2026 class and also in general. But the supplemental pieces that they brought in, and supplemental might honestly be doing it a disservice, especially when talking about guys like Carson Bailey, who has the look of someone who could potentially headline A&M's rotation in 2026. He's a really good arm from the left side. But they also brought in MJ Bollinger from Florida Atlantic, who will be one of, if not their most used relievers in sort of a fireman role next year. Jake Dewar had a really productive year also for the Owls. Biggest wild card in the class for me is Preston Prince, a former Rutgers left-hander. From a stuff standpoint, you know, he is elite. Like, the stuff with him is big time, but the one drawback is that the command and control is a 20 on the 20 to 80 scale. And this is kind of a deep pull here, but he's reminiscent of former Xavier left-hander Nolan Hughes, who was a 2024 draft pick by the Washington Nationals. Both are 6'5", 6'6", left-handers. Hughes' stuff was unbelievable. And I remember seeing him on the Cape in 2023, my first year with BA. And from a stuff standpoint, he was eye-opening and borderline jaw-dropping. But similar to Prince, it's 20 control. So if they can somehow hone it in with Preston Prince and get him around the strike zone and up the competitive pitch percentage, he's the biggest wild card in the class. And that's a low risk, really high reward move to get him to College Station. So I think with who they have returning as well, Gavin Grahovic, Shane, Caden Sorrell, Shane Sadeo was a big returnee who just announced that he was coming back to school. I think it's going to be really hard for them after what happened this year to not be playing with a massive chip on their shoulder. And this portal class is a really nice cherry on top.
Well, it certainly feels like they're going to need to have a big year with this roster the way that it is, especially after the way that last year went. This year kind of feels like a gift for this Texas A&M coaching staff, and maybe one that was deserved. I mean, you talk to any player who's come through that program when Michael Early has been there, and they would tell you that he's the right guy to be in the dugout for them. So a big year for Texas A&M. Let's now have a discussion about some classes that have maybe flown under the radar here a little bit. I think that this is a good year for the underappreciated, especially with the lack of, you know, super top-end talent that has come through the portal. This may be the season to talk about the classes that have done the best job of finding the gems. Is there one that stands out to you as the most slept on class? Let's go back and forth for our most slept on class.
Most slept on. I really like what Oklahoma did in the portal. Okay. I was down to a couple of schools. You'll probably pickpocket me just knowing how aligned we usually are, but I'm a fan of what the Sooners did. It's a group that's headlined by Nolan Stevens, formerly of Mississippi State. The tools with Stevens are immense. You know, he's got plus raw power. He's got an above average borderline plus arm in right field. Season was limited due to a shoulder injury. If he can play a full 50 to 55 games, he's a chance to be a top 3 to 5 round draft pick. And on the other side of the baseball, LJ Mercurius, formerly of UNLV, I think he has a chance to blossom into a monster in Norman, and that's a rotation that's got a lot to replace with the departures of the Witherspoon twins, particularly Kyson and Cade Crossland. But Mercurius showed flashes as a freshman in 24, took a step forward this spring, fastball up to 97 with some hop in the top third of the zone, but the gyro slider is a really effective swing and miss pitch. And he rounds out his arsenal with a mid-80s changeup that is also a really effective swing and miss pitch. It had a 41% miss rate this year at school. As he fills out the entire arsenal from a sharpness and also just pure stuff standpoint, figures to tick up. And then Cam Johnson, a Wichita State spark plug, kind of just this lean, wiry, athletic, and quick, twitchy kid with fun tools. Body type is a little reminiscent of current big leaguer Brooks Baldwin, and also the play style a little bit. So I'm a real fan of that class. And there are some supplemental pieces that I didn't even get to that'll kind of make this thing go. But those are the big three in that class.
Let's see if I can tap into your mind here. My pick is Kentucky after a lot of thought. There it is. Let's go. Yeah, I really like how this Kentucky group looks. I think this is actually one of the top classes in the country, and it's just not being talked about nationally as much as it should be. Connor Madison from Grand Canyon, I think, has a chance to be a star for them on the mound. Tyler Cerny from Indiana is somebody who you and I have talked about a lot dating back to the preseason. We've thought pretty highly of him. He figures to have a chance to start in their middle infield. Jack Bennett from Western Kentucky is a really good pitching addition for a rotation that kind of gets blown up here. Nick McKay is now either off to the pros or off to greater adventures. Alex Duffy, the catcher from Elon, maybe not the flashiest addition in the country behind the plate, but somebody who I think is going to do a really good job for them. And importantly, there's a style of play to how Kentucky kind of does things. And you know that Nick Mangione, head coach Nick Mangione, is in his bag when they're starting to collect the talents that really agree with their play style. There might not be a player who does that better than Jace Tharnish from St. Bonaventure. He'll be a senior next year. I am really bullish, and I know you are too, because we included him in that 10 underrated players story that I mentioned a couple minutes ago, on Tharnish. I think he's awesome. He hit .403 with 7 home runs and struck out just 27 times with 17 walks. Also stole 32 bases last season. Was caught stealing just once. Super athletic center fielder, 6'3", twitchy athlete, fast hands, not afraid to get hit by a pitch, which is something that they breed into their Kentucky hitters. And he can move on the bases, which we both know to be a big deal in Lexington. That class is really, really good. I actually would put that class in the top 8 in the country right now. I think it's an outstanding group compiled by head coach Mangione.
And as we talk through it, And we each had them tabbed as a sleeper. I'm actually kind of pumped you picked my pocket on it, because it validated what I was saying, and also we were able to give it a lot of love. But I'm with you, where it's not even really necessarily a sleeper class. Like, this is a really, really good group. It's for all the reasons you mentioned. They kind of fill in some necessary holes that they got to plug as we approach 2026. Jace Tharnish, as you said, is a real dynamic addition in an up-the-middle profile. I think the hittability and speed with him, the speed particularly on the base pass, though, as you alluded to, he's a really good athlete who can go and get it in center field. Those two traits make him a really valuable player, especially in Kentucky's system. And he could hit at or near the top of the order. And then you have Tyler Cerny on the left side of the infield to supplement Tyler Bell, presumably at third base, where Cerny will play next year. And so that's a really good and solid left side of the infield. Ryan Schwartz, who's also returning, showed well across the limited sample as a freshman. And I'm pretty sure this summer he's gone gangbusters with the Amsterdam Mohawks in the Perfect Game League. I think he's hitting like .450 something. But anyways, Madison, there's a chance he earns a weekend starter spot in the SEC. I'll be really excited to see how the stuff with him translates to a big time uptick in competition. The changeup with him is a no doubt plus pitch, but the fastball is a little bit light, and so is the slider. But the compete level with him is off the charts, and he's got this really fiery kind of infectious mound presence that I think rubs off on everyone with whom he shares a dugout. So he's a fun arm. And I think Tagger Tyson, who, you know, you could view as sort of an underrated piece in an already underrated class, he did a good job stepping in for the injured Matt Klein at Louisville. He hit just a shade under 300 across a 30 or so game sample. He can handle himself behind the plate, but you can also plug and play him on either corner infield spot and either corner outfield spot in a pinch. So this is a, I'm really, really happy with the group that Coach Mingione and company were able to put together.
One other underrated transfer for that Kentucky class that I think is worth mention, righty Jackson Jelkin is somebody who is extremely intriguing to me. He was a draft pick in 2024 and then went back to Houston, got hurt, transferred to Kentucky where he missed a season recovering from Tommy John, and then announced that he's going to back to school as a 23 or 24-year-old now, I believe. Fastball sits in the mid-90s, good slider. Somebody who I think is really intriguing for them as well and also has a chance at a weekend starting spot. Really good class for Kentucky. Let's broaden things out here as we start getting into the home stretch of this podcast and talk about the big picture. The college baseball calendar, Peter, has been a hot button topic this offseason so far. I spoke with 20 coaches, all of whom anonymous, who gave their feedback on what they thought about the college baseball calendar. I'm going to put that up on the screen for the world to look at. We're going to discuss it. Basically, and you can read the entire article on baseballamerica.com/college. The consensus among coaches right now is that the calendar is a little bit busted. And the reasons that they find it to be busted can be narrowed down largely to three different categories. How the draft is scheduled. They don't like the post-2021 move to mid-July. They want it to be closer to Omaha. But more importantly, they don't want the transfer portal, which is issue number two, to be opening and closing before the draft occurs. The concern among these coaches is that with the prevalence of the transfer portal and how much players want to go in and move schools and look for opportunities, it is impossible to fully plan for your roster if we are having the portal close prior to the draft. And then the last issue that was interesting to me was just the fall and how the fall was scheduled out. A lot of coaches who I spoke with did not want a fall window. Some did. Others basically said, listen, you know, we got to do what we got to do. And they were a little bit more indifferent to it. So the bottom line, though, is that coaches want things to change. And again, if you're watching this, you can look at the screen right now. We have the list of the different questions that were asked and how the 20 coaches who we spoke with netted out on some of the biggest topics. Where do you stand on the college calendar? Are there things that stand out to you as particularly troublesome that we need to correct soon as college baseball kind of goes through these changes and makes decisions on what's important?
I think I align sort of with the majority here, especially as it pertains to the draft and that return to early June. For what it's worth, I haven't spoken to anyone, whether it be a scout or a college coach or just anyone within the amateur space that's a fan of the July draft. I think it throws a huge wrench into everything, both on the amateur schedule and the summer ball schedule. But, I think a move back to early June sort of centered around Omaha would be way more productive. And then it's also clear that the portal just needs regulating. Obviously, with when it is, I'm in agreement with this move and sort of extending this the window a little bit beyond the draft and just from a roster planning standpoint. But also with the rules surrounding it, like to sort of say the quiet part out loud, there is rampant tampering going on. And that's not a shot at any one or handful of schools. But there is so much tampering going on with guys that aren't in the portal and trying to lure them in with lucrative NIL deals or, you know, whatever it might be. And trust me, if it's like, well, if you're sitting here and listening and kind of thinking, well, the coaches aren't reaching out to these kids directly, because we'd hear about it. Trust me, if a school wants to get to these kids or a certain kid that they're targeting or wanting to get into the transfer portal, they'll get to them. And whether that's through really creative back channels or, you know, via an agent or an advisor, like, they will make sure that that kid knows what's potentially on the table. And again, that's not a shot at any individual program or programs in general, but we've got to hone it in and rein it in a little bit with the regulations surrounding it all. It is legitimately like the wild, wild west, both with, you know, kids entering and, you know, the, what we've got going on with contacting kids. So I think that it needs some retooling to kind of get to its maximum productivity, both for players and schools alike. Because on the player side, you have kids entering the portal who were starters or in prominent roles at their respective programs, and maybe they were, you know, at a little bit of a smaller school or even a Power Four school, and they enter the portal just because it's kind of this shiny, exciting object. And they go in the portal and they commit for an NIL deal, and then they don't play at their new school or get passed over at their new school, and they're back to square one the following offseason, and all of a sudden you're looking at a kid who's at three schools in 3 years heading into his draft year. So there's a lot that's wrong with it. I think that it's, you know, I think there's enough that's right with it too. But we've got to refocus a little bit.
I think that is absolutely the case. And that opens up a broader conversation as well that isn't necessarily schedule related, in that there does need to be some portal refinement here. One thing that I heard in Omaha during the State of College Baseball press conference with NCAA officials was from the director of championships, Anthony Holman. He said that the NCAA is mulling over the idea of creating unique portal windows per sport. I think that solves some of the problems that you just brought up. I don't think tampering is going anywhere. It's going to be one of those issues in my mind that's just kind of a, this is the way it is now sort of thing. There are still wins that happen at the mid-major level in the transfer portal. I pointed a guy like Blake Gillespie, who transferred from Georgia to Charlotte. And, you know, to my knowledge, and would be surprised if I was wrong on this one, there wasn't a lot of tampering going on there. That was Gillespie trying to find his spot. And that's exactly what he did. He was one of the best pitchers in the country. And I think he and Coach Woodard over there had a really good connection that allowed them to thrive. And that's a win for the transfer portal and for college baseball. One thing that I agree with that I would change, and it's not listed on the charts right here, so I'm going to get rid of it, that had some support from coaches, was pushing the start of the season back. There were a couple guys who said, listen, we solve all the problems that we have. This is the transfer portal opening and closing before the draft. This is the transfer or the draft not being close enough to the end of the college baseball season. A lot of the issues they say are solved by moving the draft from the start of the season, from early February to early March. And in addition, and this was, I thought, a really interesting piece of this, in 2020, Clemson head coach Eric Backage, who was at Michigan at the time, he and a couple other coaches put together a proposal that was sent to the NCAA that basically said, we need to move the season back to early March. Here's why. And the reasons ranged from cold weather teams are going to save a lot of money because they're going to be able to play more regional games earlier on in the season, and they don't have to travel to these, you know, Arizona or Florida, or like Michigan this year went to Puerto Rico to open the year, these invitationals that are very expensive. Most baseball programs lose money, and if you can schedule more regionally, you save money. And so that was, you know, argument number one. The second was you give these players a little bit longer of a warm-up period and maybe cut down on some of the arm injuries. And the third, and I thought this one was really interesting, is perhaps college baseball continues to grow in on-campus popularity because there's less crossover with other sports. There's no more conflict really with basketball, or at least the meat of the basketball season, the tournament time. And once you're able to do that, are you putting more fans in seats in the baseball stadiums because they don't have anything else to go watch? So that was kind of the three-pronged argument with regard to moving the season back. I agree with all of those points. It seemed like, based on the conversations I had with these 20 coaches, that there was some pretty widespread support for that plan as well. Would you be for or opposed to moving the season back?
It's an interesting thought. I think for me, what comes to mind first is summer ball, sort of as we would know it, especially when talking about the Cape and the Northwoods and the NACBL. That would sort of not only throw a massive wrench into it, but, you know, sort of end it as we know it. But I think there are some pros to it. I don't totally hate the idea. I think we can all agree that there's refining that needs to be done on the college baseball calendar and just the amateur calendar in general. I don't know if moving the season back almost a month would be my first move. But it's certainly an interesting thing to think about.
Let's use that as our summer transition here, Pete. Last section before final thoughts. You are out there every day in the Cape, seeing all the great things that it has to offer. What are your some wood bat snippets to share with the audience, the great people from this summer?
Yeah, it's been a fun summer. Two best hitters I've seen off the bat, without a doubt in my mind. Well, three best, four best, I guess. Now I've talked to myself about this, but Brendan Lawson on Florida freshman star, as the thunder ominously rumbles in the background of Jacob's setting. He's been one. Chris Rembert for me has been my 1-1 hitter up here this summer. He didn't come back after USA, much like all the guys that go to USA, but he was exceptional. He'll be a big piece for Auburn next year. AJ Soldra, who was just drafted a handful of days ago. Aiden Robbins has been really impressive. Mike Anu, who's transferring into Arkansas, has been eye-opening. I wrote about him in my transfer rankings on baseballamerica.com and a number of different pieces. Ace Reese was great pre-USA, and so was Jaron Advincula before he headed home. But, man, on the pitching side, like, I'm not going to mince words. It is really, really light.
Can I interrupt you, Pete? Talk about Ricky Ojeda from UC Irvine.
Go. Yeah, so Ricky Ojeda is another guy pre-USA who was excellent for YD, through 6 1/3 scoreless innings, 11 Ks, just 3 hits allowed. He's going to be a really, really big piece next year for UC Irvine. He's expected to step into the Friday starter role. Fastball this year, he upped the velo a little bit by a couple of ticks. Bumped 95, 96 a couple of times with some life at the top of the zone. Pairs it with this big, kind of slow, loopy breaking ball for which he has an advanced feel. The strikes and quality of strikes with him are really, really high level, and so is the pitchability. He's a pitcher, not a thrower, and that's a cliche saying, but he really knows how to pitch, which is kind of rare to say about a lot of these, you know, amateur arms. And the compete level and mound presence with Ricky is off the charts. Like, it is, sort of this blinders down mentality, tunnel vision type of deal where he's just perpetually in attack mode. And I think it's going to serve him well, not only this year as he makes the jump into the rotation, presumably, but also throughout what I think will be a really lengthy professional career. So he was one of my favorite arms that I saw before the draft in USA kind of gutted everything. Same with Cole Carlone for reasons we've talked about, but man, it is slim pickings at this point in the summer, let me tell you, especially on the pitching side. Like, nobody is still up here. And I think that this is a problem just with summer ball in general, but especially with the Cape, and seeing it in the last few years. Like, there is no reason and no incentive for these kids to stay. Like, I don't know how we got to this point, but it's almost like we've convinced these guys that the best way to get better and the best way to spend their summer is by not playing games and by not playing more baseball. It's sort of mind boggling to me, especially on the pitching side, because you have a ton of these arms who come up here, and quite frankly, they didn't pitch at all this spring because they weren't good enough for their respective programs. And they make 2, 3, or 4 good starts up here, totaling 12 to 15 innings, and then chalk it because they got to quote unquote rest up for the fall, where all they do is just throw against their roommates and guys on their team. And I think a lot of coaches around the league share that sentiment. Some of them have tweeted it. Yeah, and scouts do as well. And what I was just saying was, you know, Coach Shevchik, who does an excellent job with Brewster, Brendan Lawson's skipper this summer, actually, he said something very similar that he tweeted out. And I think that encapsulates sort of how everyone is feeling to a T. So how you fix it, I don't really know. If you're a coach in this league or you're, you know, trying to get guys to play for your team, I think it's sort of that adapt or die mentality for Moneyball where you just kind of have to figure it out, because I don't see it reverting back to what it was. But the league right now is in a really weird spot. Like, I think if you took the best players on the Cape right now on July 22nd, as we record this, and have them playing a game against the best players in the NECBL or the best players in the Northwoods, they'd probably get mopped by those two teams just because of the quality of guys who are staying for the entire summer, largely on the pitching side. So it's an interesting spot. It's really a great place, and there's no better place to watch baseball throughout the entire summer. But, man, especially before the draft and in the lead up to that and pre-USA, it's really, really high quality baseball in professional baseball. But after that, it gets gutted quick.
That's going to be your final thought. That was really good. And I'm going to spare you having to come up with another one. That was
two birds with one stone.
There you go. So there's Pete's final thought of the podcast. Mine will be about UCLA, to kind of try and preview what's coming at Baseball America. Over on the website side of things, this UCLA team has had an excellent offseason by effectively not doing much. It brings back the vast majority of the team that we just saw reach Omaha. That's the case on the offensive side, where Rock Chalowski and Mulevi Levu, two All-Americans, and Rock Chalowski, of course, being our 2025 Player of the Year, only the sixth ever sophomore, non-draft eligible sophomore, to win the award. So their lineup is back. A lot of their rotation is back, and they bring in some really intriguing pieces via the transfer portal, none other than Will Gasparino is headed over from Texas. I think he has a chance to be outstanding for this UCLA team. And I just view this Bruins squad as maybe the quiet favorite, even with, you know, it's not the hugest transfer portal class. It's basically just Gasparino, but there's a reason for that. It's because they have so much coming back. And so I think that to me stands out as possibly, hint, hint, the number one team in the country. The way too early number one team in the country. And I'm going to leave it at that. Head on over to baseballamerica.com/college to see our way too early 2026 top 25 on Wednesday, July 23rd. Depending on where you're listening to this podcast, we hope that you enjoyed, watching or listening to us. And for this episode, that's going to do it. So again, head on over to baseballamerica.com/college for all of our written content. For Peter Flaherty, my name is Jacob Rudner, and we will see you in 2 weeks.